You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics, graphic novels, and cartoons. Today's show continues our month of shows looking at non-practitioners' love of comics. Coming up, you'll hear my interviews with Kenneth Baker, former British Home Secretary from 1990 to 1992, and now Lord Baker of Dorking, who has helped curate the latest exhibition at the Cartoon Museum in London about 60 years of caricatures of the Queen, including art from his own personal collection. Also, John Huddy, founder and curator of The Illustration Cupboard, a small but perfectly formed gallery of picture book, comic and book illustration art in Mayfair. Finally, in today's show, recorded also in that part of the world, are last week's announcements of this year's Manga Jiman winners at the Embassy of Japan, announced by Cultural Officer Simon Wright, and Minister Hiroshi Suzuki, Director of the Japan Information and Cultural Centre. Before all that, here's a word from our sponsors.
I love Resonance FM. On St. Valentine's Day 2012, Resonance 104.4 FM will launch a week-long on-air fundraiser, and London's finest radio station needs your help. From the 14th to the 19th of February, Resonance FM will be running an on-air auction of novel experiences and unique and desirable items. Get ready to tune in, dig deep, and keep Resonance 104.4 FM on air.
Talking to Lord Baker of Dorking. We're at the opening of Her Maj, an exhibition celebrating 60 years of unofficial cartoons of our Queen. I believe many of the cartoons in the collection are from your own personal collection of cartoons.
Some are. This one is actually, which is one of the jolliest. This is the Punch cover in 1977 for the 25th Jubilee.
Okay.
And as you can see, the Queen and Prince Philip are depicted as pearly King and Queen. Mm. That they're wearing dark suits with little buttons buttoned all over them. There's nothing more English than a pearly King or Queen.
Indeed.
It is the essence of it. Bow bells, Cockney and all that. And they're happy and they're doing a dance. And it rather reflects the enjoyment and the enjoyment of the people that the Queen's still around, as it will be this year. You know, the Queen has had a fairly easy ride from cartoons over the years, and that reflects the attitude of the country, basically, to her. They like her, and they wanted to go on for as long as possible. But when she started in 1952, the cartoons were incredibly deferential. She was depicted as a sort of fairy queen, almost. Mm. And for 20 years, none of the cartoons depicted her face. It was always the back of her head, or she was off the scene, something was watching something happening elsewhere. But after the BBC programme in 1969, when they opened the doors of the palace to the family, then that opened it everything. And from then on, she was depicted as a figure, obviously. You saw her face and all the rest of it.
Mm.
But even so, she was always depicted in a rather friendly way, often in an official way. There's one cartoon where she's depicting all her robes on the throne, saying when Margaret Thatcher is also depicted in a very hard way, bowing before her, and she's saying, "Why are you asking me to appoint another 300 peers?" And Margaret is saying, "These are the people I've sacked from my cabinet for being disloyal." And the combination of Margaret and the Queen were very nice. In the first opening of Parliament, there's a Giles cartoon of the Queen putting on her crown. Now, in those days, Margaret always wears a hat. And the corruption is, we'll see who has the best hat today. And so the contrast of the two strong feminine characters was interesting. Of course, the kindness did not extend to her children. When Charles and Diana broke up, they really got in the neck from the cartoons. It was very tough, hard stuff. And so it was with Fergie and the Duke of York. And there was one cartoon there, the House of Windsor crumbling away and falling away, which it hasn't done, of course. But that phase has passed. And then there were one or two other difficult moments when the Queen used that famous phrase, "Annus horribilis." Palace of Evilness, and that was when the winds have burned down and one of the divorces was happening. And then she's depicted in a very sour sort of way, saying, thank heavens this year is going to end. And there's another lovely one in this collection here, when she first had to pay taxes. She's looking very fed up indeed, drawn by a woman caricaturist.
Well, I was going to say, one of the interesting things about this exhibition, as well as being all about the British attitude to the Queen over the years, which, like you say, has always been very friendly, it's also a history of British cartooning, beginning with Ernest Shepherd, who's better known for illustrating Winnie the Pooh, and ending with Posy Simmons, who's known for her graphic novels as well as her cartoons.
Absolutely right. And you see, this emphasises how important graphic satire is. Graphic satire was the one art form we've invented in our country. It was done in the middle of the 18th century by William Hogarth, depicted social decline, the rape, l'art's progress, the rape's progress, l'âge à la mode. And from that, political cartooning developed. It didn't develop in France or Germany, Italy, because they had censorship. In France, if you criticise the kings, you end up in the Bastille. Louis XIV would even further. He had a cartoonist torn apart by four horses. And now, we didn't do that. We laughed at our kings. We laughed at George III and George IV. And when we laughed at them, we don't cut off their heads.
Indeed not.
And the other queens had a very easy ride, even easier ride than Queen Elizabeth, Queen Victoria. I could only find one cartoon in the whole of Victoria's 63 years that was critical. And it occurred after Albert died, and she retreated to Windsor and became the Widow of Windsor. You know, Kipling says, have you heard of the Widow of Windsor with a hairy gold crown on her head? And she withdrew from public life. She didn't even open Parliament. People didn't see her for years. And there was one cartoon magazine called Tomahawk of an empty throne with a dust cloth over it. That's all it was. Well, the editor was chucked out of his club. He was ostracised. People challenged him to duels. That's as far as it got in the whole of Victorian England.
Well, it seems appropriate that the nearest that someone in this country could get to treason is through cartooning. That, you know, there is meant to be an element of risk, you know, to the whole medium.
Yes, cartooning is all about freedom. You can measure the freedom of a country by the freedom of their cartoons. Russia today, if you did a disparaging series of cartoons on Putin, you'd end up with your fingers broken. That's the least thing that would happen to you. But suddenly your job would disappear. Your house would disappear, all sorts of things. And that happens across the world. It of course happens in the Arab world as well. And it happens in any country which doesn't like free expression and free tax on people.
It's interesting listening to your passion about cartooning, because you seem to bring out how it's very much an English tradition of freedom, of creativity, of passion. Did you become interested in political cartooning the same time you became interested in politics?
Well, a lot of the cartoons are about political people. The first one I collected 60 years ago was one I didn't understand. It was a Gilray of William Pitt driving the coach of George III in. I found out about it, and I realised this is the way you could tell history. So I wrote various books on it, history of George III and George IV, and it's a wonderful way to see the history of those reigns, because they didn't have photographs. People didn't see official portraits. The only way they could recognise their kings and queens was in the print shop windows. And so I believe that's a very good way of learning history.
How large would you say your collection of cartoons is?
Oh, too large. Far too large. But I started collecting them. They're much cheaper. And they're much more expensive, unfortunately. But other people collect them now.
And now I suppose you're in the position of lending them to exhibitions like this.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. This museum is a tremendous success. We started 5 years ago. We get no money from the government, nothing from Boris. And we have to live by our wits. I have to raise £100,000 a year for it every year. And it is the only public building in the country that aims to send people out happier than when they arrived.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Her Madge, 60 years of unofficial portraits of the Queen, is on display now at the Cartoon Museum, Little Russell Street in London, until the 8th of April 2012, nearest Tube, Tottenham Court Road, and you can find more info at www.cartoonmuseum.org. Next, here's my interview with John Huddy, founder and curator of the Illustration Cupboard in Mayfair. I was reading your biography, for want of a better word, on the Illustration Cupboard's website, and it says that you studied history of art at St Andrews, you got an MA, you then worked at Christie's, and it was a combination of those things as well as a family connection with publishing that led to the creation of this. What was that family connection?
Well, I think I was very lucky because I grew up in surrounded by books. My mother was a writer and a publisher. And her great friend Julie McCrae had a company called McCrae Books, Julie McCrae Books, that was one of the best sort of picture book publishers for many, many years, 25 years. And they worked they started Anthony Brown, and they published Raymond Briggs books and a whole host of names, which people, Quentin Blake and all sorts, really. So they published an awful lot of very well-known illustrators and authors. So I sort of grew up with these people coming in and out of the house and hearing their names and stuff. So we were always aware of that. So that's really how this entry into book illustration happened, really. And I knew a lot of publishers as well, because Julie McCrae Books was associated with Walker Books and Random House and Franklin Watts. So, it was an opportunity to be taken, and so that's how it started.
And when you started talking to publishers of illustrated books, did you find that they were delighted that there would be a central hub where, in fact, you'd be able to find exhibitions of book illustration?
Yes, I think people were very... they were certainly very interested and supportive. And, again, I have to mention Walker Books there, who helped me out with the first exhibition I ever did in 95. And I couldn't have done it without them. You know, I went in for lunch and we went through all their sort of top people, and they very kindly sort of passed on a letter, and that's how it started, and they've been very supportive ever since. But I think nobody really knew where it was going to go then. You know, I literally started with one exhibition, thought, give it a go, see what happens, you know, if not we'll just have to let that one go. And it just went from one to the next. There was never any real conscious decision to turn it into, you know, a great industry, which hopefully it seems to be heading that way.
Was there more snobbery back then in terms of illustration and putting it in a gallery environment? Has that changed as the gallery's been open?
Yes, I think that's very true, actually. I think one of the great battles that we've had in the last 15, 16 years is getting that message across and making people realise that book illustration is a valid art form in itself. And I think, you know, we've gone a long way to redress that balance. And I think people now really appreciate it for what it is, in some cases more than so-called fine art, I think. So I think a lot of ground's been covered,
Because if people now want to see an exhibition about illustration art, there's obviously the Illustration Cupboard, but... For example, right now, the Hayward Gallery has an exhibition of Trigley on. The Cartoon Museum near the British Museum obviously has a rotating collection of cartoon art. Have you seen, while you've been running this place, more and more exhibitions on the subject opening up elsewhere?
Yes, very much so, and it's very encouraging. Certainly, again, one of the challenges when I started in 1995, 1996, certainly up until about 2000, was that there was just very little interest and there was very little opportunity. I mean, people were, you know, saying to me, John, what are you doing? You know, they just didn't understand it. So getting the message across was critical. But then there was a big sea change, and I remember talking to Liz Hamill, who's now Seven Stories, and she was telling me about her ideas and what she was trying to do there and get that off the ground. And then that came about, and then the House of Illustration with Quentin came, and, you know, that started up as well. So gradually over the last few years, there has been a lot more interest and a lot more institutional, you know, really proper interest, not just passing interest. And I think there's also a big change with people's attitudes, as we've discussed. And I think also that one of the great sort of knock-on effects of the contemporary art world is that television programmes, you know, there's a whole host of programmes on television now about collecting, and I think this has had a knock-on effect, and now people are collecting all sorts of things, of which illustration artwork is one. So I think the general increased interest in the art world has benefited book illustration,
the exhibitions that I've seen at the Illustration Cupboard, David McKee, Sean Tan, Brian Wildsmith, I mean, they show the varied style of illustration that obviously that you exhibit, from oil painting to watercolours to mixed media. When it comes to curating exhibitions, do you try to keep it as varied in as much as the subject matter as the way that the art is created?
Yes, I think it is interesting to try and show as varied and as much as possible. And I think this is part of what I think is very special about book illustration. And I think it has the edge over the so-called fine art world, because I think illustrators are incredibly creative. You know, their end product is the book, and they will do anything to get to that destination. And they don't consciously think about the media that they work in. They just use what they have to use. And gosh, I've seen all sorts of weird and wonderful things that people have produced to get there. So that is part of it, yes. And it is nice, you know, to work with these very, very, you know, creative people and see what kind of artwork they have. And there's, as I say, there's quite a varied, you know, within a relatively straightforward remit, people are very imaginative in the way they go about things. So it is nice to try and bring that in, because I think it's of interest to visitors to the gallery, definitely, yeah.
And I guess also when you see the original artwork, sometimes it's quite a different experience to seeing it on the page, because if something's mixed media, it may need to be photographed in order to flatten something that's actually three-dimensional in real life into a flat image. And then conversely, when you have something like the 2000 AD work by Kevin O'Neill that you have on the top floor, that'll also include corrections where he's used white out or pasted bits of paper over the top and then drawn over those to correct his art. So both of those things really give you an insight into the way that the art is created.
Yes, that's very true. And certainly a lot of work has corrections on, which, you know, particularly with the digital era, gets sort of, you know, covered over in the finished book. So that is, as I say to people here, there really is no substitute for seeing the real thing, because you see the notes in the margin that the artist has done, the corrections are made, the mistakes they've made, and that is actually part of the whole rich tapestry of book illustration. You know, it's not just a case of I'm looking at a beautiful object. It's I'm looking at a beautiful object, and quite often you're seeing the way that creates it as well. I mean, one of my favourites, I think it was one I remember, was one of Rome Briggs's drawings, and it had a shopping list down the side of the drawing, which I thought was rather good. And then Charlotte Folk, I remember once, she had a lovely drawing, and all the way down the side there was a list of music, and she'd obviously been listening to Radio 3 that morning, and every time she liked something she wrote it down. So it's fascinating in that respect. Yeah.
And in terms of the remit of the gallery, have you found that you've kind of expanded the definition of illustration the longer that it's been open? Because in the last year alone, you've had an exhibition of Cosgrove Hall art, so that's actually been the animation. You've had the work of Sean Tan, who's a graphic novelist as well as a book illustrator. And like I said, Kevin O'Neill, who's very much a comic book illustrator with very angular pencil drawings that is very much kind of black and white British comics.
Yes, well, that's interesting. I'm not sure whether it's chicken and egg, really, whether we've expanded the definition of illustration or whether the gallery's just expanded into different areas. I'm not sure, but I see what you're saying. And yes, you know, that we are an illustration gallery, and that's a nice umbrella title. And so we're trying to sweep under that umbrella all sorts of different angles, like exactly as you've just described. And I think that's good, because picture book illustration is part of it, and that's very interesting. I love it. But, you know, there are other things as well. And at the end of this month, for example, we're working with a chap called Tony Healy, who did all the Rumpole of the Bailey books. He's a political cartoonist. That's an area we haven't really done anything with before, but I'm looking forward to it, because I think political cartoons, and Chris Riddell does a lot of that as well, is an area we'd like to bring in under the umbrella, along with things like graphic novels and, you know, film artwork and storyboard artwork and stuff. So, yes, I suppose we're trying to extend the remit. Yes, exactly.
Well, and I suppose in terms of illustration absorbing influences from other media, whether it's comics or TV, the Rumpole illustrations are a good example of that, because we've got some on the wall behind you now, and it's clear that those were created post-Leo McKern as Rumpole, rather than being an interpretation of the character as how he's written on the page.
Well, that's it. It is. There is an overlap there, and there is a crossover. And it is, as you say, it crosses over between the film element of it and the book and the artist and the interpretation. And I think that is quite significant, because there is this increasing sort of grey aerial overlap between all these different areas that were so very separate years ago. Well, it seems to me they were separate anyway. Whereas now, particularly in the digital era, you know, illustrators aren't just book illustrators, they're often doing films as well, like Sean Tan. So there is quite a diversity of interest within the whole field, I think, which is coming together, you know, under the way people work. So yes, I think that's a very good example. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. And illustration in general, the way that it's interested you over the years, all of the different kinds of art that you've exhibited here, whether it's book covers, picture book illustrations, comic book illustrations, all of those things have in common the fact that it's art depicted on the page alongside words. And so the two have a relation with each other. Do you find that there's something very different in that, where art is juxtaposed with text, that the two mix together and perhaps create something that's different to art that's created purely to be seen on its own?
Yes, I think it is a very different art form in that respect, and always will be. And I suppose that's where some people have always seen it as the little brother of the art world, because it is functional and it has a reason for being, you know, it has a reason for being created in that respect. But then you can flip that round the other way, actually, and say, well, actually, all artwork is illustration anyway. I mean, you can look back through the history of art, and most of the great names you can think of, like Goya and Fragonard, and I mean, look at the drawings of Leonardo da Vinci. A lot of his sketchbooks were illustrative anyway. So you could say that all art is illustration to some extent. But to make your own judgment on that comment, I don't know. But I think that there is, because of this, as I say, the artist is, the illustrator is on a journey towards a destination to produce a book. That means that the essence of what he's doing is, or he or she is what he's doing, is very different from art for art's sake. You know, it is not it's not an indulgence in that respect, which is what I quite like about it. I mean, I quite like the fact that these artists are producing something which is to be used and is to be created into a book form. And I think that gives it, you know, I quite like the fact that that art for art's sake is often not in the equation. I think that actually can be rather distracting. And I think that's, in some ways, talking to a lot of people who come to the gallery, and, you know, I think a lot of people are perhaps a little disillusioned or bored with a lot of contemporary art, because they can't really understand it, or it's all very conceptual, or, you know, and I think people, that is why I think the interest in illustration has grown enormously, because it is very accessible and people can understand it and they can see it and they can appreciate it and they like it or they can dislike it. But, you know, there's an entry point and they can engage, which I think a lot of things perhaps you can't these days.
And obviously this gallery has been successful, that, you know, you've been here a decade and a half. Obviously the rent in this part of the world must be astronomical, so it pays for itself. But at the same time that it's been popular with gallery visitors and people who want to buy art, have you found that art critics who have come to your exhibitions, it's kind of changed their opinion of illustration in terms of write-ups of the exhibitions you've put on?
Gosh, I'd like to think that's the case. Difficult to say. But what I can say is that certainly the interest that we get from the media and the reviews that we get and the comments that we get from the media have become more mainstream in recent years, which is, I think, you know, that sort of says it all, really. You know, one can have articles in, you know, the broadsheets, which 10, 15 years ago didn't happen. So I think that in itself is a sign that, yes, people are taking it more seriously, so to speak, in this country anyway. I think we lag behind. You know, if you look in America and Japan as well, the Far East has a very high regard for illustrative work, and I think perhaps we lag a little behind in Britain, but I think we're catching up now. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you very much. The latest exhibition at the Illustration Cupboard, The Art of Rumpole of the Bailey by Tony Healy, runs from the 20th of February to the 10th of March 2012 in the ground floor gallery at 22 Berry Street, London. While a permanent collection, including work by Sean Tan, Kevin O'Neill and Cosgrove Hall, can be found in their upstairs gallery. More info at www.illustrationcupboard.com. Finally, in today's show, we have a recording of Simon Wright, who's the next voice you'll hear, and Minister Hiroshi Suzuki, awarding this year's Manga Jiman Pride in Manga competition at the Embassy of Japan in London.
For this fifth Manga Contest Award presentation ceremony, I'm sure all of you who are here tonight are big manga fans. I still remember one day I had a severe tympanitis in my ear. I had a bad case of inflammation in the ear, and my father told me, "Oh, Hiroshi, the bad news is you have to go through a little surgery. The good news is, if you don't cry, then I will buy you a brand new book of Atom Boy." So I amassed all the courage I could amass, and I did my best not to cry. And indeed, my father bought me a book of Atom Boy. And this is one of my favorite memories from my childhood days. So manga in myself evokes a very strong emotion coupled with nostalgia. Now, I arrived in London just over five months ago, and this was the very first time for me to serve on the panel of judges. And I was pleasantly surprised at the very high standard of quality that the old applicants demonstrated in submitting their applications. And among the panel judges, we had heated discussions, to say the least. Every year, the embassy presents sort of a theme or a topic around which we encourage applications to be submitted. And this year's theme was the new beginning. We thought about this theme because of, against the backdrop of this March 11 earthquake and tsunami. As a result, no applicant wrote manga on the exact tsunami and earthquake. But nonetheless, each and every applicant thought about this theme, and each manga submitted was very rich, not only in their manga drawing techniques, but also in the content as a story that they presented. Now, I am told that on the one hand, the popularity of manga in the UK shows no sign of decline. But at the same time, I must be frank to admit this to you, that the number of applicants this year has seen a dent. So I would like to take this opportunity to encourage all of you to spread the word of mouth that next year, please submit more applications, even though it could mean a bit harder competition for all of you. And without further ado, I'd like to hand over the microphone back to you, Simon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Suzuki. As Minister Suzuki said, there are four judges altogether in Manga Jiman. As Minister Suzuki said, there are four judges altogether in Manga Jiman, and sadly two of them can't be with us tonight. They are extremely disappointed that they couldn't make it. However, they have sent their comments, and I will share just a few of them with you now. So from Paul Gravett, I found that the overall standard of this year's Manga Jiman entries was noticeably higher, with an impressive range of styles and approaches based on the open theme of new beginnings. Entrants were generally more ambitious in their stories and more polished in their narrative techniques. Everyone shortlisted for this year's competition should be proud of their achievement and encouraged to pursue their passion for making their own kind of manga. Good words indeed, I think. And also from Ilya, I think Minister Suzuki also mentioned that there was some heated debate, and you might have a clue in this here. "I think this year the overall level of talent," says Ilya, "and execution was an improvement in general standards. This by itself is encouraging. As reflected perhaps in my comments above," which I haven't said, "this year is the first where I have felt quite so out of step with the final choice of eventual winners. Usually my own personal top choices tally with the final running order more closely. That said, I felt the judging session this time was lively and perhaps the most interesting that we have had so far. I do not disagree with the final outcome. The top 10 taken as a whole, arrived at very much as a group by earnest and considered discussion. The fact that for the first time I am unable to attend the awards ceremony causes me great disappointment. And I'm sure a lot of you will also have benefited from Ilya's feedback in the past. He's very thorough in what he does. Let's get on with what you're really waiting for, shall we? You'll see that there are some gaps around the exhibition where there should be names above various pictures. That's because they've got the position on them as well, so we can't put them up just yet. Third place. Goes to Dean McKnight and Jade Sarson with Sheer Brilliance. Second place prize is a Toshiba laptop computer, courtesy of Toshiba of Europe. So, the manga which we nearly called Kokoro no Kido, it's... Lorenzo Fruzza with The Heart's Orbit. That means there's only one person left, the winner of Manga Jiman 2011 and 12, Elena Vitaliano. The deeply The award presentations are now over. Thank you very much. Please relax, have another drink, have some sushi, and enjoy the rest of the evening. And I think Minister Suzuki has already hinted maybe we can see you all again next year. Thank you.
An exhibition of this year's Manga Jiman winning art is on display Monday to Friday at the Embassy of Japan, 101 Piccadilly, London, until the 28th of February, and you need photo ID to enter the building. The nearest tube to the embassy and the illustration cupboard is Green Park, and you can find more info at www.uk.emb-japan.go.jp. Starting tomorrow evening on Resonance FM, the station's annual fundraiser is taking place until midnight next Sunday. Throughout the week, there's an auction of unique and wonderful items, special live events, celebrity guests, spontaneous competitions, and much more. If you enjoy Panel Borders and other shows on 104.4 FM, please show your support through a donation, a pledge, bequest, or purchase from our shop. Resonance urgently needs funds to continue its work, and the alternative, to have to take on-air advertising, would dilute and curtail the wide range of programs currently on air. Previous guests on Panel Borders have included DJ Food, Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, Marjan Satrapi, Art Spiegelman, Philip Pullman, Audrey Neffenegger, Raymond Briggs, and many more. So to ensure that future episodes of Panel Borders and the wide range of other great programs made by Resonance FM continue, please go to www.resonancefm.com to find out more. Panel Borders was recorded, introduced, and edited by Alex Fitch. You can find the complete catalogue of previous episodes at www.panelborders.wordpress.com, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.